You're listening to a 4x4 Radio Network podcast.
The Center Steer Podcast, a Land Rover podcast by Land Rover owners. Welcome to the Center Steer Podcast, the only Land Rover podcast on the planet. This is show number 49 for April 2017. I wrote that earlier, but all of a sudden it stunned me. This is a podcast by, for, and about Land Rover owners. Visit our website, centersteer.com, which is spelled in the British way, C-E-N-T-R-E, to listen to previous shows and for show notes, which have links to stories discussed in today's show. We are part of the 4x4 Radio Network, and I invite you to check out our other shows on the network at 4x4radionetwork.com. Special thanks to our Patreon subscribers. You helped a little bit in my travel down to SCAR, and also I purchased, and I've only sent the picture to Patreon subscribers, of the Center Steer tire cover, thanks to the thanks to Patreon subscribers. And also thanks to all our listeners for your comments, follows, likes on Facebook, Twitter, email, and in person. Because I, when I went to SCAR, which we'll talk about a little later in the show, I actually met listeners at SCAR, so it's very cool. And if you're a new listener to the show, welcome. Hope this is everything you ever wanted. When it comes to the Land Rover community discussion, I will say this in advance. Before I do that, I'm your host, John Costage. I'm here in Western Pennsylvania. The weather today is abnormally warm. It's actually humid in the 80 degrees. I always like to talk about the weather. Harold is not available to join us for today's show because he's doing important things. For important people, he's working on my truck. But joining me from the Green Mountain State over via Skype.
Hi, I'm Morgan. And, you know, on the weather topic, we have chilly, rainy weather, and we actually had to turn our heaters back on. So
what?
I'm maybe a little jealous. I don't know about humidity.
Yesterday was perfect because it was not humid, and it was probably in the 70s. So, yes.
We've had a nice run of good weather, so I'm not really complaining about chilly and rainy. Our, you know, our garden could use it, you know.
Indeed.
Oh. And for our listeners, especially the Patreon subscribers, just so you know, even I have not seen the tire cover yet.
I'll show you a picture later. How's that?
Sounds good.
It's true, you have not. You're not a Patreon subscriber.
I know. Should I start paying to participate?
I think you should. Possibly we might have some new listeners, and you may be a Series truck owner. You should check out seriesparts.com. Morgan runs that site, which, if I remember correctly, I got to try to remember this every month. It is your central site to locate parts or garage for your Series truck.
Correct.
Good man.
Thank you.
He also runs our heritage segment for the show, which we are delaying because, hey, it's life. It's the way things are. We do this out of the goodness of our hearts. And while we do have some support from our Patreon subscribers, just, you know, events of the day, sometimes we don't get to everything. So there you go. That's that.
And don't worry, we have plenty to talk about in the meantime.
And we do, absolutely, because we've already recorded and we talked to our guest this month, Martin Port, who is the art director for Classic and Sports Car magazine. Fantastic stories. You're going to really enjoy them. Recently learned I had 3 degrees of separation from, he's a bad guy too, I can't think of his name, Charles Manson, and I was 4 degrees of separation from Hitler. So those are all bad things that I've recently learned, but a good one. I'm now 3 degrees of separation from Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back, and the James Bond franchise. So that,
yes, you get very
to,
cool.
You get to listen later in the show and find out why that is the case. That's all thanks to Martin. As I mentioned earlier, I attended SCAR. We're going to talk about that towards the end of the news. It's a little preview. Fantastic event. I had a great time. What a wonderful event. If you are in that neck of the woods in northeast Texas, you have the opportunity to go, I would recommend it. Don't even question, think about it, just go. It's a good event, well run, managed. There we go. We'll talk more about it later. So but before we do that, we're going to we'll get to the news. So why don't we start with the news? It was very good for Jaguar, Land Rover as a company, and for Tata. My favorite headline out of the year's the year sales information was one Jag Land Rover sold every 30 seconds in March. I thought that was a neat little headline.
That's a very good number. And easy to count too.
Yeah, for the entire year, I believe of 2016, Jag Land Rover, which for those who maybe again our new listeners not follow along, that's Jaguar and Land Rover put together as one company under Tata. They broke the 600,000 unit mark, which is the first time in history that Jag Land Rover has sold that many cars. We didn't do any research, but I just thought of this. When they say that, does that go all the way back? Did they take like Jag and Land Rover back to like the 60s and put them together to find out? Or are they just, they're only looking at JLR for the past, 10 years they've been a company themselves?
Yeah, they must be looking at JLR because didn't they produce the millionth Defender while they were right at the end of the run there.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And then how many ever hundreds of thousands of Defenders. And good point.
Yeah.
So things have been really good for JLR in this last year. U.S. sales are up. They're strong. They had record-breaking sales in China. Trying to find my numbers here as they broke this 600,000 barrier for the first time in history. Specifically, they sold 604,009 vehicles, including sales from its joint venture in China. They have the increase here. Why can't you never find these things when you need them quickly? So China market was up 32%. North America market up 24%. The UK was up 16%. Europe was up 13%. And other overseas markets, which they do not define in this article, they fell by 6%. I'm guessing that's Africa, maybe Australia would be my guess. And
my guess would be that's because they no longer have a Defender.
What? No, they would never do that. Why would you do that?
I mean, how many of the discos and all of those newer vehicles do they sell in overseas markets in terms of those additional markets that they group together?
They group together, right? Yeah, the big sales, though, are Evoque and Defender Sport. Defender, yeah, I'm getting ahead of myself. I know nothing special. I don't know where that came from. The Discovery Sport. Which is interesting because that's the smaller cars, right?
It's true, but also both of those have been out for a few years now. Whereas if you think of it, the LR3 and the LR, I mean, even the LR4 was not really a change from the LR3 at all. So the first new Discovery was the Discovery Sport, and the Disco 5 only just came out, yeah, or is just at the motor shows, right?
I did see. No, I did not. I did not see any at SCAR. No D5s at SCAR. But, yeah, I don't think it's available here in the U.S. yet, is it? Not till the fall.
No, I think they're doing was it L.A. or New York Auto Show to show it off?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. So things have been very good in the sales department. Some other interesting bits of note out of that is that the U.S. market for Jag Land Rover is very, very hot. but the CEO, Spaeth, predicts that the U.S. market, at least I think it's Spaeth. Oh, no, it's Joe Eberhardt. He's the North American JLR CEO. He thinks that the U.S. market has plateaued and that things are going to probably cool down a bit. He says that there are rising inventory levels. Manufacturers are using more incentives to counter slowing sales, which only destroys brand value. And the customer shift to SUVs over cars will, quote, makes for a little less comfortable environment this year compared to the last couple of years. I hope the industry will have some discipline not to fall back into bad behaviors of the past, unquote. Of course, the F-Pace is doing very well for Jaguar. I think it was this article where I read it? And this is when we need Harold, because they mentioned that the F-Pace, oh yes, this is it. Here we go. The company's F-Pace mid-size crossover SUV class came to market in 2016 and in many ways took Jaguar, quote, back to its roots, unquote, says Eberhardt.
Well, I'll play Harold here and say that that's not their roots at all, and it's a vehicle they should never even have made. Place making an SUV.
Why say that back to its roots? Roots of what?
Right. Since when did
an SUV is not a sports car?
Ever make an SUV?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's not a sports car. I mean, yes, you can turn one into that by throwing a turbocharger, and is the Land Rover's done. But you know what else is Jag known for? Sleek design. racing.
Right. Yeah, wherever Harold is right now, he just got chills.
What happened? For Tata, JLR, we've talked this before, but they have a number to it now. For Tata, JLR is 82% of their global passenger vehicle sales. Let me repeat that because I think that's critical. Or just, I don't know if it's critical. It's amazing to me, I guess. So JLR contributed as high as 82% of Tata's global passenger vehicle sales.
That is impressive.
Amazing. So interesting. So interesting.
It was probably a good decision for them to buy up JLR.
Indeed it was. And a good decision for JLR to be purchased by them because, that was a right fit also because Tata seems to have kind of left them alone, let them do their thing, and given them the money they needed to build new plants, to build new engines for the first time ever, their own engines. All that came as a result, and which is obviously good sales as a result of that. I will say on the interesting side of that, I don't know if it, maybe it's a negative, while sales have been going up, why is that? Because of the design and the vehicles that are available that we like one of. We don't need all of them to look the same. But, it's a kind of interesting dichotomy, right, of things are doing very well, but it's what's behind that. It's kind of, in our, at least here on the podcast, kind of not going in the direction we wanted to go.
Yeah, but it's also the direction that all the manufacturers and markets are going. So, it's as much we can be dragged along kicking and screaming.
right.
It's happening to everybody.
Indeed. Which kind of interesting too, along those lines, while sales are up, things are going very well, the Jaguar, I think he was the US president. Yes, here it is. We're back to Eberhardt. He's the JLR CEO, North America CEO. Told Ward's Auto, quote, "We have to continue to grow, but we are not looking to grow at the pace we have been. All the growth still does not make us a giant luxury brand. It makes us a bigger luxury brand that now has scale, but is still a special and exclusive." I think, and then somewhere here, I don't know if they quoted him on it, but they don't want to grow too big, which is kind of odd to me for an automaker to say, we don't want to grow too big. I think he's just kind of curving the information to the facts versus saying what he wants, and then here's the facts to support it, because, they've only broken 600,000 units. They're still JLR, Land Rover's what, 0.1% of the U.S. market, and so Jag would be even less than that. They sell half as much.
Yeah, they have plenty of room to grow. He's just trying to turn it around, spin it so that they're not too cool.
Oh, there you go. I thought of that. Yeah, they're not too cool. So, our cars are so cool. Don't buy one. Yeah, that's, yeah. Well, and then there's this rumor out there. Well, that's going through your head about, Jaguar is JLR is very big, doing very, very well. Are they? They don't want to be too big, though. But there's this rumor that, this is not the rumor part of it. Apparently, Ralph Spaeth, who is the JLR president, he's the global one, Ralph Spaeth, is targeting 1 million annual vehicle sales. So that would be increase in, almost double from what they are now. And this is the rumor part of one way to do that would be for them to purchase Vauxhall and use their capacity, and would also give them a kind of a cheaper car line in order to sell more vehicles by volume. So there's that going on where you've got the Jaguar, the North America president saying, well, we don't want to grow too fast. But you got the global president going, hey, we need to grow fast.
Well, that brings me back to the earlier question about from Eberhardt saying that he sees the U.S. market slowing down slightly. I wonder whether that's, again, a little bit of spin. I mean, clearly it's also him trying to project for the future, but here in the U.S., we don't have any JLR hybrid vehicles, and those are really big in the U.S. And I wonder if we're not seeing that. I know that JLR is working on hybrids, especially on the Jaguar side, but whether we'll see those, whether those are going to limit some of JLR's sales,
I don't know.
Just
a question.
Yeah, just something I thought of related to all of that.
Right.
Now, is Vauxhall still Ford right now? I can't remember.
I believe it is. I think it's still, and I think, didn't they shut down Opel Opal will be shut down. I
can't remember.
Too bad there's now, no way to check information in a global fashion. I'm sorry.
I know, and quickly at that.
Quickly.
Man, if somebody would invent some kind of global network
of information that could be easily accessed from many locations.
Yeah, like intra-company, intra-country, intra-computer.
Yeah, almost like anyway. You could send a telegraph and the telegraph would respond to you in real time for the specific information you wanted. Yeah. You could telegraph a newspaper. The newspaper would get you the information. Anyway.
If only.
Yeah.
Before we digress too much further.
Yes, but it looks like the thought here, this is Automotive News thinking that this is more of, I guess, an editorial piece. This guy can envision JLR creating for Vauxhall a Subaru-like lineup of subcompact, compact, four-wheel drives, hatchbacks, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, which actually makes some sense. And, I mean, they're already pushing in that direction, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, I would say that the Range Rover Evoque is a little more in that direction. It's still luxury. It's obviously still above, like, a Subaru level. But it certainly matches Subaru in capability, probably exceeds Subaru in capability.
Right.
But it definitely sounds more like a Freelander.
Right. Right?
I mean, the Freelander was really not that much different from today's Subaru Forester.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right. My thought, though, was that Land Rover's already creating these families. And yeah. I think that was my point about how, I think we'll see the day soon when Land Rover becomes the mark and then Range Rover becomes the company name, and it moves away. And then you're going to have... you'll have the Range Rover as the mark, and then the model is going to be something, Range Rover, and then you'll have Range Rover Velar, and you'll have Range Rover Sport, and you'll have Range Rover, and then the Evoque, and the Evoque is the model. You know, I think you'll see that kind of stuff. Then you'll see Defender and Discovery, and then you'll have a Discovery. And then, anyway.
Right. Yeah, that's a good possibility.
Well, yeah, so we continue to watch that. I still always like to mention this stuff because it's amazing to me. Let's run. So, because I can see this on your registration in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania from PennDOT, I can see this now. Make Land Rover model Range Rover, Range Rover Evoque. It's like, or Range Rover Velar, and maybe SV something something, whatever. Just like, how long can this get? And all the words sound the same.
Yeah, it's fairly ridiculous, and it's understandable that when the Range Rover first came out, that they didn't. Name it the Land Rover Range Rover, because that would have just been too much for anybody to swallow.
Right. And yet I still have my friends who say, how's that Range Rover? It's not a Range Rover.
Well, it's too close for people who are not interested in it to differentiate.
On some just quick news, business news, JLR says that they would like to return to building in Coventry. So there's some – that's Ralph. Spaeth again talking about that. There was the standout for me on that was not necessarily that they want to go back to Coventry to produce vehicles, but what he said, they were talking to the government about this, but what his perspective is on the future of automotive manufacturing. Quote, the automotive industry is going to see more change in the next 5 years than we've seen in the last 50. We're going from the internal combustion engine to autonomous, connected, electrified hybridization, but also there are mobility issues. I'm not sure what the mobility issues are. So that was a standout to me. Things are going to change a lot. I think we're seeing that already, and I think we're aware of it. But apparently, it's coming very, very quickly.
Yeah, and it really is going to change how companies operate so much. Especially for a company like Land Rover and JLR, who have produced vehicles up until very recently in the almost ancient method of building by hand.
Hammers and duct tape. Yeah.
Exactly. That they've only just recently shut down that old method completely and have switched everything over to the modern method of building a vehicle. And that's just going to flip over and change again. They're already in the midst of doing it. It's going to be really interesting to see how that does affect companies. And Land Rover already has been utilizing for quite some time some of the shared platforms that all the auto manufacturers have been using to reduce the amount of customization and buildup of assembly lines and all of that. Land Rover still prefers to highly customize those platforms, but they still use them. And I think those platforms are going to grow increasingly. It'll be very interesting to see where they go.
Also, JLR is renewing commitment to engine research at Imperial, so that which is apparently there's a college, I think, there. Yeah, the center was originally established at the University College London in 2013, so they have, I think, appointed a professor on thermofluids in mechanical engineering, so they want to continue to help out with developing fuel-efficient powertrains and such, and so they still want to do that.
Yeah, it's good to see them, you know, still pushing the envelope. They're already doing that in the engines they're designing, their Ingenium engines. Probably some of their previous research funding has already paid off in that area. And it is good to see that, since Land Rover vehicles being sort of heavier off-road long-range vehicles in general, they can't be necessarily switched over entirely to electric as easily, certainly with existing technologies. So seeing them push for more fuel efficiency and lower carbon output is good to see.
And Land Rover has patented a central tire inflation system, and it seems like, really? But it's actually pretty cool, the idea of it, because you could do, you know, they already have, many of the vehicles already have air suspension, so why not use that air to you know, connect to the tires, and then you can inflate and deflate as you needed. And the nice thing about this, so if you're on the highway and, you know, when you get the highway speeds, you can increase the tire pressure so that the tires are, you know, less footprint, a little narrower, and they will get better fuel economy. But then when you go off-road, you can deflate them to get better, you know, to get better traction when you're off-road. Or if you get stuck, the vehicle may automatically know that, would automatically know that this one's not getting enough traction, this tire's not getting enough traction, so we could deflate it, just that one tire, to get a bigger, you know, get a connection and then help get you unstuck. And it's pretty pretty ingenious.
It's very cool. And military vehicles have had that technology for a while, and it's extremely helpful. But, it, you know, there's also the potential for reducing some maintenance. Obviously, having air plumbing throughout an automotive structure, it generally adds to more maintenance issues. But, you know, if you can make sure that your tires are automatically always to the correct air pressure, that's going to mean better tire wear. You're going to have much more mileage out of those tires. You're not going to have to necessarily rotate them as frequently.
Better fuel consumption.
So there's some nice benefits there.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, as the headline is, Land Rover patent would put military tech in your Range Rover.
It's very cool. It could be a lot of fun.
Of course. Range Rover is marking its 50th birthday anniversary. Sully Hall, they are having a special exhibition for the 50th anniversary. They have opened up that exhibit, similar to the Heritage Line. They're having the Range Rover story. And so if you're in the neighborhood there, you want to check that out. Also the couple articles, of course, we'll have links in the show notes. You can see what they're talking about there. So it goes along with our Heritage segment, and the happy birthday, Range Rover.
Exactly. It's very cool that they've been doing these factory tours and showing off how they originally manufactured these vehicles. They did a nice job timing, you know, the re-release of their first re-release Range Rover Classics. And it's just very cool to actually have that set up so you can go tour it, see it. Very nice. No other companies are doing that.
No, the Defender Celebration exhibit attracted 11,000 visitors in 2015. They got Roger Craythorne, Mr. Land Rover, to come back and help out with the Range Rover story. And he said, the quote, "The exhibit tells the incredible story of the Range Rover from the original Velar prototype through today's new model. At the time, I began my career in 1967 as a technical assistant on the Velar team. The intention was never to build a luxury vehicle. Over the 50 years since, the Range Rover has come a long way. We wanted to develop a more comfortable on-road Land Rover that would combine the comfort of the Rover with the Land Rover 4x4 capacity to support a growing leisure market." So it was a good summation of where the Range Rover came from.
Very good. And there's some very interesting aspects to the development of the Range Rover that we've covered in some of the Heritage segments specifically the fact that they designed this vehicle, their engineers just set out with that goal to create a more comfortable 4x4 vehicle
coil
than the Land Rover. And they designed a structure and a body that fit on it and they thought looked nice enough for them to test with and that looked nice enough for them to go test with. And they brought in an external designer to sort of redesign the body. And the designer looked at it and said, this is actually a really nice looking vehicle. I'll just touch up some small bits and it's good enough. So very cool in very many aspects of that development.
And speaking of the Velar, but this is the actual Range Rover Velar. They just debuted the actual model, not the prototype. But we now know the cost for the U.S. market, the 2018 model year. It's going to start at $49,900. But nice thing, this I think we talked about this before, but this is a little more, confirmation. They're going to have three powertrains, a four-cylinder, 180 horsepower, two-liter turbocharged diesel, a four-cylinder, 247 horsepower, two-liter turbocharged gasoline engine, and a six-liter, 380 horsepower, supercharged three-liter gasoline engine. And, of course, they'll have all the usual trim levels, and then they're going to have also this new thing they've started with the first edition. They're going to make 500 Velar first editions featuring a signature sound system and special paint finish. So I'm sure that will not be starting at $49,900, however.
Probably not. I suspect that you're going to pay a fairly large sum to be a beta tester for the new Velar.
Yes. And now it's time on the show for our monthly So Says Jerry segment. I think we need to almost have a special sound effect, shouldn't we?
We do. So. I will not attempt to make one up on the spot.
So Land Rover's design chief, Jerry McGovern, had another interview or an interview that they've now released where the quote is, "Our job is also to dream." So we'll take a few minutes, go through what Jerry has to say. The reason we do this is that Jerry is integral to the future of Land Rover. He's designing the vehicles that we like and enjoy and takes us, this is the future of Land Rover is evidenced by the Evoque, and you can see where that went. And of course, we all very interested in the Defender and what is the new Defender going to be. So I think we are reading tea leaves, admittedly, but they are, I think, some important tea leaves to read. Did I do okay with that analogy? I don't know.
I think so, yeah.
I will say, and I should advance to get to the end. Finally, I have found something that Jerry and I agree on. We don't seem to agree on too much. But at the end, they asked him kind of a fun question about what does he listen to, what's his favorite car music, and he goes, "Well, he's driven around a lot. He doesn't get to listen to music, and he also is working in the car." But he said when he did have more time, he really liked groups like Genesis, Emerson, Lake and Palmer, The Stranglers, and Roxy Music. So there's at least two bands there maybe three that I particularly like and enjoy. So finally, something that Jerry and I can agree on.
Exactly. So if you're ever in the same room with him, you can listen to music, but you probably should not talk Land Rovers.
Jeez. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. All right. I don't know. I know we talked about this stuff before, but I guess I don't know. So it's all, again, it's design, then function follows. In the past, he says that the design folks were not where they reported to the engineers, and now the engineers and the finance people and all that, they all report to this. They're all on the same level. So, that helps. Design is not an afterthought, I guess is one way to look at it. But again, design is, for him, is important. He likes minimalism, reductionism. So I think that's why you see that in the Velar with the door handles that pop out. But he also understands that technology was necessary to make that happen because, in the cold, they could get frozen. So they made sure that they had the right technology to bust through some ice to get that. And so they would make sure they would open and get into your car. The way to look at this is Jerry's thinking and where he's coming from. And I think this certainly informs where the Defender is going to look like.
It's sort of the usual interview in that aspect.
Indeed. There was one, there were really no other standouts for me on these things. It's the stuff we've heard about in the past, and maybe I'll just let you guys read it on your own. Of course, we'll have a link to it. You know, this one quote does stand out. For me, it's a sum of all the elements. This is a quoting him. Because everything needs to be fundamentally correct. The volumes, the balance, the proportions. That's how we develop the surface to refine the details. We can add the most beautiful details to a car, but its proportions, its volumes aren't right. It won't be beautiful. And that was a question of, is there one element that he really likes about a car? So for him, it's the balance, which I guess may be a good thing for the Defender because there's some balance to it to make it look beautiful.
And I would say that they've actually done pretty well on the volumes and proportions on the new Land Rover vehicles.
Come on, what about the bulbous front end? That I don't know if that's really, I think it's bulbous.
Yeah, I do. But they are also, putting a lot of technology back under that hood, so or bonnet. They have to do that. But as much as we tend to say that all the new Land Rovers look like Ford Explorers, at least the more modern Ford Explorers, one of the areas that they really differ is if you look inside a Ford Explorer and you fold down all the seats, you have all of this plastic stuff that's in the way that's sort of just flowing out into the passenger and storage compartment. This is there for safety to make sure that there's, large enough impact zones that everything can crush and preserve the inhabitants of the vehicle, the passengers. But one of the things that Land Rover has done really well is make sure that they've really maximized that internal capacity for passengers and for other cargo. And I don't see many other manufacturers doing a very good job with that.
Yeah, to your point, actually kind of another quote from Jerry or a thought from him is, you can have all the studies and analysis in the world, but the vehicle must first and foremost provoke an emotion. It needs to be something visceral. It's a bit like technology. It's fantastic. It makes our lives easier, but it's only about the technology. But if it's only about the technology, is it exciting? Not really. His point then about emotion, and I think it goes to your point too, that you have the nice looking vehicle on the outside, but the inside, there's also, if they don't spend some attention and time to that, that there's an emotional attachment also to the interior.
But it's true, and functional as well. But yeah, mm-hmm. And with the Discovery 5, they've gone so far as to, because of the technology, they've been able to redesign the interior and use a whole bunch of previously unusable space. For example, they now measure some of the storage box capacities and number of iPads that you can store in them, which previously those storage cubbies were never something you actually expected to store much in. You toss some gloves, some spare change, something like that in there, but that's basically it. Now there's actually real capacity, real usable space there. I think they're pushing that even further with the Velar in terms of removing a lot of the unnecessaries from the interior. It still feels a little not Land Rover-like when you look at them, but...
Yeah, where do you mash the yellow pedal? Where's that? Where's that?
Exactly. There is the minimalism that they have strayed from in going with all these fancy features, whereas they could have gone minimalism and gone more towards like Defender and series Land Rovers. And that's the kind of vehicles we tend to miss. So it's still not easy.
Indeed it is not. I'll let our listeners read the interview for themselves, and maybe they have some comments they want to pass on. But there's one thing that stood out, and it's somewhat in Jerry's defense, because this doesn't make Jerry look good at all, I don't think. I don't know if it's the way the article came down, but they wanted to get this out. They were talking about the Evox and design and that business and when it was released, and he says that and it's an even bigger challenge. In addition, we've never made that kind of vehicle before. In the case of the Evoq, the people in the marketing, people in marketing, predicted we would sell at most 30,000 units. We've sold 130,000 of them. And then the article does not quote Jerry, but says themselves, as Jerry admits with a slight smile that the person who made that prediction is no longer employed with Range Rover today. Why would...
Yeah, I hope that that was not Jerry, because it, it gloating, makes it come across as a little bit vindictive gloating,
right.
But,
right.
You know,
superior.
It's... Yeah.
Yeah, I'm hoping...
For his sake, we'll give him the benefit of the doubt.
Exactly. We don't know why that guy left. I mean, it almost sounds like, well, he didn't know his job, you know, or they were wrong. Well, maybe it was even a guy. We don't know. You know, what happened to that person? Maybe they left of their own accord for other reasons, that, you know, they had a death in the family, or they, you know, they got married and moved or something. You know, it's maybe someone in Jerry's defense. It doesn't make him look all that good. It makes him look like, as you said, kind of condescending. And maybe you didn't say condescending. I did.
Maybe, yeah, but that's another good adjective.
It was a good adjective. So, all right. Well, that's our Jerry said segment. Should we move on? If Harold were with us, I think you all know what Harold would have said. Yeah. A couple more quick bits of information about Land Rovers and old Land Rovers, for that matter. There is UrbanGhostMedia.com, and I'll have a link in the show notes. You can see pictures of abandoned Land Rovers in the Indiana Jones stable. So apparently these were... abandoned Land Rovers stacked neatly between the walls of two neglected barns. I think these were, known to the urban exploration community as the Indiana Jones Stable. Though the abandoned Land Rovers aren't thought to have been used in the popular Hollywood franchise, they're in this Indiana Jones Stable, probably because of what it looks like. You know, you're kind of, it's an adventure place. I still didn't figure out where they're located. Where are these things?
So urban explorers, or sometimes referred to as urbex, they tend to be very vague on where these locations are, because they're generally illegally trespassing on these locations, not for any nefarious purposes, but really just to go in, see what's there, photograph them, leave, not touch anything, not take anything. But they generally don't publicize all that well where these locations are.
Yeah, if you want to see abandoned Land Rovers, they have nice patina. That's about all I can say. Right?
They do. They're definitely packed in there and covered with dust, but they have good patina.
I do. I found the Land Rover Santana brochure from 1970. I think it was tweeted out, and so I have a link to it now in our show notes. But if you want to see the Santana brochure, I believe it's in German. No, Spanish. I think it's in Spanish. Sorry.
Yeah, my Santana apologies. Was a Spanish company.
Spanish company. Yeah, exactly. They were knockdown kits, weren't they? They knockdown kits sent to Spain, and then they created the Santana, or did they make their own vehicles?
They actually manufactured them, but they may have started with knockdown kits. I'm not sure where they started. At some point, they did officially license them and produce them. And in fact, after the series Land Rover was discontinued, Santana kept building series-style vehicles. So basically the same drivetrain and everything, and leaf spring suspension as opposed to coil suspension when Land Rover switched over to the Defender and stopped producing the series. Santana marketed them as sort of the better, stronger Land Rover because they felt they were a more durable vehicle.
Indeed. Finally, this one gets me boiling a little bit, I suppose. This gentleman has done reviews that we've had on the show in the past. His name is Doug DeMauro. I keep thinking I should look at his other reviews for other non-Land Rovers, but I know, these ones annoy me, so I don't know if I'll get to it. But he bought a North America spec, completely restored. It sounds like it was restored from the frame up. Cost $70,000. Of course, it cost like, what, $30,000 when it was fresh out of the factory? Completely restored by a guy he knows. It's nice. They repainted it. He had it for 5 miles and immediately took it to Paragon and took it off-road with a Jeep, a Toyota. Not a Toyota. F-150.
Ford
F-150 and a modern Range Rover.
I think it was the Ford Raptor, actually.
Oh, it was. It was the F-150 Raptor. You're right.
Yeah.
And a modern Range Rover.
It was the Range Rover Sport, or was it? I think it was the Sport.
No, No, it didn't look like a Sport.
It was the Range Rover?
It was a full-size Rangy, yeah.
Oh, you know what? I think it was it the Discovery Sport?
No. It was a full-size Range Rover.
Okay.
It was.
I don't know why I'm confused on that. It's been several weeks since I watched that video.
That's okay. This guy's clueless. Is he normally like this?
A little. I think he does know his stuff.
Does he just come across?
He likes to poke fun, and he's a little annoying.
A lot annoying. Well, this is the one that really got it for me. That I, you know, like, okay, it's cool that he bought a Defender and he's keeping it on the road, and he, you know, it's a complete, you know, frame off restoration. Great, wonderful. Kudos to him. And he generally likes the vehicle. He does say that he enjoys it. I think there's a little bit of passion for him in it, which is nice. He seems to be a passionate vehicle guy, which is good, and I appreciate that. But and kudos to him for having it, you know, fresh off the showroom floor, and he takes it right to off-road, as we almost all of us would have done. So kudos to him for that. But, and this is what really got me, towards the end, they're going up a steep climb, and there's a little bit of rocks. It wasn't that bad, but, you know, okay, you know, granted, a car couldn't have done it, but he says, well, the Range Rover, you know, the Defender, it took me three tries, and they show him, you know, he goes, I backed up to give a little more power. I didn't want to turn on the center diff, and I didn't want to put into four-wheel drive. I'm like, and then 2 seconds later, he says, the Jeep got through, the F-150 Raptor didn't have any problems, the Range Rover, it made it look easy. It just kind of climbed right through without any difficulty. It didn't even seem like it had a problem. Yeah, you know why? Because the Range Rover did what it's supposed to do. It engaged the center diff. It turned it into four-wheel drive. It knew how to throttle. It knew where to steer. Dude, it did it. And then you didn't want to do what the Range Rover does for you.
Exactly. Yeah, he's... I think he actually was in four-wheel drive, because I don't think he would have gotten over it otherwise.
Well, but true, you're right.
Yeah, when he chose not to lock the center diff
says, I didn't.
It would have been easy.
I didn't want to lock the center diff. Well, what?
Yeah.
No wonder you spun tire. You had one wheel come off the ground and the other three, and no wonder you didn't have any traction, and you didn't, you know, the truck is made for that stuff. Then you're like, oh, it just comes off buffoonery, you know, and
Yeah, if you've Who's got this? The Range Rover, you can just drive it as it was intended, and it does it all for you.
Who's his audience?
I mean, but his audience is mainly car nuts on YouTube. He was previously a Jalopnik writer, and I think he's now an Auto Trader writer. Okay. And he often takes a lot of input from his audience.
Never read the comments, right? So he reads the comments.
I think he actually picked this vehicle based on user feedback. So he asked for users to submit every type of vehicle that he should buy next. And I think he picked his top 10. And I think number two in that list was a Defender. And he picked a Defender. He currently and previously has driven for the last few years a Range Rover HSE, probably like, you know, 2005, 2006 era, something like that, which has had numerous problems. It actually has, it's a little entertaining, but, you know, he's still a little annoying about showing off the issue. He bought it with a CarMax warranty, paid like $6,000 for it, or $6,000 for the, or maybe it was $4,000 for the CarMax warranty. As of, I think, honestly, a couple of days after he posted that D90 video, he surpassed like $12,000, which is more than the vehicle is actually worth at this point in terms of warranty repairs. But he seems like he is a genuine Land Rover fan. He's still kept running that Range Rover this entire time. And even though his warranty is going to expire soon, he expects to keep driving it, and he off-roads in it. He clearly bought the Defender out of his top 10 list and likes driving it. But I think he could spend a little more time behind the wheel learning to drive the vehicle with the features provided. If he wants to drive it without a center locking diff, he can drive a Series 3.
I appreciate what you've done by checking out his other information and keeping track of him, because I don't feel like it. It seems like the audience he's playing to is not the audience, I guess, that I would ever want.
No, definitely. I think a lot of it is for entertainment factor for the most part. I've seen.
Yes. You hit the word entertainment.
The vast majority of his videos are for entertainment factor. I recently watched one where he tries to drive a Dodge Viper to the original EPA fuel mileage specs, which obviously the EPA has changed how they do their mileage specs now, and they're significantly lower for most vehicles. And it's a ridiculous vehicle to try to drive
slow.
Efficiently. Yeah.
Right.
So, you know, that is purely for entertainment. There's no real benefit for doing that. And no, you know, like we talk about with the FC-101s, the forward controls, if you own one, you don't care about how much it costs for gas. It's the same with the Dodge Viper. It's another big V8 petrol engine. You don't drive it for efficiency.
Indeed. Well, no, there is one benefit to his videos. We get something to talk about for a few minutes on the show.
That's true. And that's, you know, that's the entertainment factor that we get out of it
is
grumbling and moaning and pulling our hair out. I don't know why that's entertaining, but apparently
It might be to some people. All right, let's close the news down. I think we're done with the news.
That's it. We're done. If I ever meet Doug DeMuro, I will happily take his D90 for a test drive.
All right, well, let's move on to event review, especially since I got to go to SCAR, which is a South Central Area Rover Rally put on by Texas Rovers, and it happened last week. And it takes place at Barnwell Mountain Recreation Area near Gilmer, Texas. I had a great time. I had a really, really good time. I should have taken notes, but I didn't. I'm doing this off the top of my head. But had a really great time. Well-organized event. Nice people. It's a great location. That recreation area is it's a off-road park. Is top-notch. Great facilities. They've got a central pavilion, which is probably 40 by 50, maybe 40 by 40 feet square. And I think they just did this recently, but it's pretty cool. They had two on each side. There were two big garage doors. So, and that was on all four sides. So you could, you know, selectively open garage doors if there was too much wind or rain or something, or you get them all open. And it was really cool. It was a neat thing. That was kind of a neat thing. And then they had another pavilion area. These are sturdy pavilions. They're on top of the Barnwell Mountain is the and where the event main part of the event takes place. The pavilions are is on top of the mountain, so it's pretty windy there constantly. So that was helpful to have the garage doors you could open and close.
That's very cool.
And they have air on site, so they have an air tank on site, so you can, you know, come down, you know, air down and not worry about I'm gonna have to, refill your air. They have air on site, which is fantastic.
Is that all at sort of like a base camp area or at the top as well?
Yeah, it's at the top. So Gilmer is, I want to say, two and a half hours from Dallas.
It's sort of east of Dallas-Fort Worth area?
Northeast.
Northeast,
generally
gotcha.
Northeast. Yeah, it's about, I'd say 2.5 hours there. And then it's, the Barnwell's about 10 minutes at most out of Gilmer. And then you come to they have an entrance. They block off the event. They have a gate there and they block it off. They rent the whole facility for the weekend just for Land Rovers. Because normally there are ATVs, motorbikes, other four-wheel drive, makes are there, and you could encounter them at any time. And so, the nice thing about this event is they rent the whole facility for the weekend, and it's all to themselves. They only allow Land Rovers on the trails, which is also kind of nice. I mean, nothing against other makes, and I did see other makes there, but they're basically support vehicles of some sort. But it's a Land Rover event.
Yeah, for a Land Rover event to have that. That's nice.
So you come in and then there's a check-in place, and then a little further down is, 200 feet. No, probably maybe 200 yards, is the central area where that main pavilion is. That's probably the center. There's a pavilion and there's an outbuilding, which I think is like their the people that run the place. They have like a garage, and then there are the bunk houses, which I would call cabins. They call them bunk houses, and there are four or five of those. I got to stay in one of those, which was really nice. Had air conditioning, a ceiling fan, and satellite television. So,
well, it's Texas. If it's wicked hot, you're going to want to be indoors with air conditioning. And if you're stuck indoors and with air conditioning during the day, TV is probably a decent thing to have.
And pretty much it all happened too. In the days I was there, it was the first. I got there Wednesday, but Thursday was beautiful day, perfect. That's when I did majority of my wheeling. Got to ride around with folks, and then Friday was stupid hot, especially when you're not used to it, and it got hot again. And then at night, as you might expect at an event, the evening is a really wonderful time. I consumed just the right amount of alcohol, was taken, got a ride back to the pavilion, to the bunkhouse, and just as I got there, the rain started, and when I got up and I fell asleep immediately, so drank just enough alcohol to put me out, and woke up, and apparently there was a rainstorm, and I never heard it.
Nice.
And then it was like 60 degrees that the rest of the event, and people were huddled up and they put their jackets on. So, but tell me that's normal. That's the way it is, and it's the right time of year for the event. It's not stupid hot all the time. There's chance of the rain and everything, which changed the trails. But
very cool.
Yeah, for the price that you for the price of entry, you also get a dinner. You get to join the dinner on Friday and Saturday, which is really good. And plus, it's a good opportunity to get everybody together in that communal thing. They have the auction, which takes place, and I will give them a special note. And I already told them this: they are punctual, and I think that's great. There's minimal rover time, as I've been to other events where this is going to start at 9:30, and like 10:15, you're like, well, we're waiting on Joe. He's not up yet. No, if they said there's a trail ride at 10 o'clock. Trail ride started at 10 o'clock, and that was great. And, of course, you don't know how long you're going to be, but generally they kept to the timing. They were going to have dinner was at 5, dinner was at 5. And, they started the auction at 7 or whatever it was. It started at 7. So that's good. It's nice. I mean, I 5 or 10 minutes, not a big deal. But I've been at events where half hour later, and it's just, how that goes.
Exactly.
But the facility is great. It's a well-run facility. They've got a bunch of trails, different skill levels. The area in my mind was a kind of a cross between Western Pennsylvania, clay and rocky area, and then slight small hills, and the New Jersey pine barrens, like those kind of trees. So not pine trees, but it's kind of short. It's kind of shortish, stubby trees. Nice area. Good trails. I went off-road, especially on did some little bit of night driving. I didn't actually do any driving, but I just was a passenger. But went off Thursday and Friday. Nice level trails, rocky, some good climbs. They're well-maintained trails. There's some challenging ones. I didn't go on any advanced trails, but I was on the beginner and intermediate trails. And they have trail leaders, they'll have a tail gunner, of course, in the back, make sure everybody's okay. They really request everybody have a CB, which is nice so you can keep in contact. But you can go off and do your own thing at the same time. They're not a stickler for you. You must go with a trail leader. But I would recommend that, especially if you've not been there before, get a sense of the trails. You can do night. You have to be done by 10 o'clock, though. You have to trails by 10 p.m. at night, but you can do night riding, I think, because of the greater neighbors. Thanks to the ATV folks who, apparently kick up a storm. It sounds like it's pretty busy outside of this event, just because it's a nice facility to go to and it's very heavily used. So,
very cool
by ATV folks. And there are special ATV trails, and I think there's motorcycle trails and all that kind of thing. So the event, the venue is great. You can camp there. There's different camping spots to go to. There are fires at night. Folks sitting around as you do at a Land Rover event and have a couple drinks and sit around a fire. And then this I've never seen in a Rover. This was my favorite part, and it really was. The guys I'd met and had been and on the road, and some of the officers even, they broke out their instruments and they actually played live music, guitar, fiddle. It's fantastic.
That's awesome.
That was like my overall, it was a highlight for me. I don't know about the best part, but it was definitely a highlight. These guys playing live music are good too. You know, so you're on fire, having a couple drinks, and you know, so that was cool.
Excellent.
I enjoyed that. Yeah,
that's
yeah.
awesome.
Very cool. Very cool. And which people ask me about the podcast, and I'm like, well, this is what I meant. My always thought was about the podcast was it in the original vision was sitting around a campfire talking about your truck and the day's events, right?
And that's exactly,
and that's what we were doing in that day. So yeah, so there's a, yeah, you can camp, people do, there were some rooftop tents, there's some people there with interesting trucks. The one thing I will say for the, especially the first day, was like, anything else but a disco. There were discos everywhere. Everybody seemed to have a disco, especially twos and ones. There were a couple threes and I think maybe a four or two, a couple fours. Don't think I saw any fives. A couple rangy.
Well, the fives aren't out yet.
That's true. Oh yeah, you're right. Of course not. Thank you. A number of them were trailered. So people had trailers and they, you know, trailered them in, which is fine.
So heavily modified ones trailered in, or just sort of everything trailered in, or, you know, a mix of everything.
I'd say a mix.
Stock and
stock.
Modified.
Yeah. I'd say most things weren't stock. From what I could tell, I think there were, I would say moderate modification to top line modification. The one really cool disco that was there and had formerly been an actual G4 disco used by the media in the G4 challenge, and we'll have more about that in a future show. Because I did, while I was at the show, I guess I should tell you this part too. While I was there, I did get to record three different segments. One with. Sarah, whose name last name eludes me, but she managed and headed up the Barber Toy tribute run, which is the, you know, the all female, all ladies trail ride. They had 18 trucks this year. They allowed me to go on as kind of an observer, and I end up in a disco, Defender, which had a 5-inch lift, articulation at the wazoo. I think you probably saw some pictures. It was a black one. Great truck. Becky did a great job. It was the first time she'd ever gone off-road, and she did a really nice job. She did very, very well. They did nice, as they do with all trail rides, actually. They have the trail leaders, you know, talk about what they're going to do, what's going to happen. They look over all the trucks to make sure they have a, you know, minimal safety check, if you will. You know, is the battery secure? You know, no leaks, no obvious leaks. And anything about any
Land Rover.
Any dangerous leaks?
No pouring.
Yeah, exactly. And they did that with normal trail rides. We also did it with a Barber Toy run, and went through. And then 18 trucks, we went off. Had a great, and I said that went very well, and did the trails and even some moderate ones. It was heard and remarked by a number of the ladies when they got off the trail that, hey, this is my truck now. So, which was really cool. It's always a cool thing, and you know, they get to see what they're capable of, and that they can, in fact, get some confidence to do it themselves. So that was a Barber Toy run, and I did talk to Sarah and interviewed her at the show. So we'll have that. My plan is to have that not next month, but the month after, and I'm going to combine that with a talk with Kevin and Christopher, who are officers in the Texas Rovers, and they'll talk about the beginning of the club and beginning of SCAR and talk about themselves personally and their trucks. Because Christopher's an interesting individual. He's originally from the UK. He might have better hair than me. Might. I'm not sure. I'm not too sure about that. It's, you know. But great guys. And so I talked to them. So I think I'll have that in a couple months and talk to them and put that on the show. And then the other third talk I had was with Bill Burke, because as you may know, he's with Bill Burke's Four Wheel Drive America. You know, it's well known in the off-road overlanding community, and I got to talk to him about Bill. We didn't talk about recovery. We didn't talk about what winch do I need, Bill? You know, no, it was about Bill. Where'd Bill come from, and how did he? And he, of course, he competed in the Campbell Trophy. So we talked a couple stories out of the Campbell Trophy, and so we'll have Bill Burke. I think that's going to be next month. Is my plan to put Bill Burke interview on next month.
That was a, correct me if I'm wrong, that was a U.S. winning year.
No, I think he came in.
No, it wasn't. Okay,
fifth. He came in fifth.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and his he was the driver. His navigator, years later, and his navigator ends up in living in Grand Junction, Colorado, which is where Bill lives in Grand Junction. He goes, yeah, I get to see him every now and again, which is it's kind of cool. It's kind of interesting. So
nice.
Little preview. I didn't. This kind of shocked me. Bill grew up in the Florida Everglades.
I think I actually read that somewhere.
Did you read that somewhere? That
That's
was
crazy.
Something. Yeah, and then so we talk about how he ends up in Colorado, and he becomes an off-road guide and, you know, well known in the circles and helps out the U.S. military. I guess I shouldn't tell you everything. got to do those interviews, and I joined in on the tribute run, which was really cool, interesting, and hoping to expand that next year and do that. And also, Sarah.
And this is the second year of the tribute run?
It is.
The Barbara Toy
it is.
Tribute run? Mm-hmm. Nice.
It is the second year. And I think last year they had 5 or 6 trucks. I apologize, I don't know the right number. This year they had 18. I suspect next year they'll probably have more, and they may even do it where it's, you know, maybe you have a couple days. It might not just be one day or one run because they had so many trucks and so much interest.
That's really awesome.
Spread it. They actually, what they could do, especially now that they've had, you know, done this 2 years, they could probably, and I don't know if they will, but they could have like the, you know, introduction and then have like an intermediate, maybe an advanced run. So you could take people on different trails. Preparatory run, talk to Bill Burke, which is really cool. We don't talk about this, so this does not reveal anything that we already talked about with Bill Burke, but did you know he plays a harmonica?
I did not.
He does. He plays a harmonica, and one night around the fire, Bill broke out his harmonica. He's pretty good.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Along with the rest of the musicians?
He did not play with the rest of the musicians that time.
Gotcha. Was on. He's more own. Of a solo artist.
More of a solo artist. Yes, Bill Burke, the solo artist. event organization, fantastic. I mean, it's well run. It's on time. As I said, they are punctual. I give them credit, a lot of credit for that. And very nice people, very hospitable, friendly, welcoming. Everybody was nice. I can't say better things about the event, really. And any negative, and that's not even, they asked me, you know, what my ideas and thoughts about improving? And they were all minor. It's like, there's nothing major you had to fix. You know, one of my suggestions was they have signs at the beginning of every trail to tell you where the trail is. Trails are marked, but then they have their own signs. It's like, you know, at night, you really can't see those. I maybe put some reflective tape around them. Or make them bright orange because they were almost like a forest green color, I think, or tan green, you know, so like blended right in, you know.
Right.
And I can, you know, so, it, you know, especially at night or even during the day, if you're not sure, you know, your first time there. I rode with a couple guys that have been there a number of years, and they're like, I think this is the way we go. You know, things kind of all blend together. They have signs, but, you know, you almost got to look at the signs.
You didn't get to drive on any of the trails? You were passenger only?
I did get to drive for all of 50 feet. I got to drive the G4 Disco. Sarah, we were on a trail, tribute run. She says, can you move my truck up? And I was like, okay. I happily did that. Got the keys, drove the Disco like 50 feet and parked it. And I was like, okay. She did offer to let me go out in the trails, but we, you know, time ran out and weren't able to do that. So yeah, they
gotcha. Yeah,
I suspect that if I were to go down next year or any time, that wouldn't be a problem. Yeah. So there were, that was the thing. I did think of, there were a lot of discoveries. I should talk about the different things that were there. And then the things that were interesting to see too, there's a lot of discoveries there. There were some Range Rover Classics, P38s, not too many of those. One Freelander did show up. I don't think it ever went on the trail, of course. I did see that.
Bad.
I took a picture of that, posted that. There was a couple that own an FC-101 and a Series 1.
Nice.
Did have pictures of those. And that Series 1 was sweet. It was a civil defense vehicle that had been imported from the UK. So it had been used in civil defense, and which is pretty cool. Nice truck. Great patina. It's, you know, pretty much, I think, all original. Nice. The FC-101, they had just gotten, I think, a short time before. It was like a two-tone paint, which looked good, but not original.
Yeah.
Do whatever, you know, it's your truck, do what you want. I thought it looked good, but I think they had some more additional work they wanted to do on it. But that was a nice shape, too. And I mean, at the end of the trip, I even had a picture of this. They had the Series 1 was getting towed by the FC on the way out. So.
Nice. So they brought both of them to the event?
Yes.
Excellent.
Yes, they did. Yes, they did. That was probably the highlight, seeing that Series 1. 57, I think it was.
Series 1.
Yeah. There were a couple other Defenders there. Oh, there was a 110 that was a North America 110. But then there was all of a sudden this Dormo.
That's a rarity.
Yes. And then this Dormobile shows up, and it was a brand new Dormobile. And we're like, what's that? And it was in Heritage color, and it had the Heritage stamp on the, you know, plate on the back, badge on the back, and it had the UE-166, is that right? Number plate on the side for the Heritage. Like, wait a minute, why is that here? Turns out it was visiting from Mexico.
So he can but it was a genuine Heritage.
Genuine Heritage vehicle. While we're talking, let me look at the number, tell you what number it was. I'll look at the pictures. But it, yeah, genuine. And he, of course, he deployed the tent for the Dormobile, which was so cool.
I thought that's why I got into Series Land Rovers, was wanting a Dormobile.
Put pictures on.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I the pictures I have of it are on my Flickr account, which I. Let's see if I can get access to it while we're talking to tell you the number. It was a numbered one. I should have done more research, right, to let you know what was what. But yeah, so there was that and he came in, and I think they're like, well, hey, dude's here, let him in, you know. And and why wouldn't you? That was a cool thing to see. And here it is. It is 24 out of 41.
That's awesome.
Yes, and it was, so yeah, that was the nice. And an actual Heritage Defender 110. So that was a nice great vehicle. Neat to see. I was going to try to talk to the guy, but it just never happened. Discos, Barbatoy Series 1. Lots of discos. Nothing wrong with discos.
They're very prevalent.
They are. Disco's the new series truck, right? That's what.
Yep. And down in Texas, down in the South, they last. Up here in the Northeast, not so much.
That is correct. Yeah, that's definitely the case. Yeah, they have less of an issue with. Although I guess if you were to get closer to the coast, you might have some problems with salt. Is the Gulf?
Yeah, if you had a coastal vehicle, you would definitely still have salt problems, but it's. Unless you're beach driving, it shouldn't be as bad as up here in the Northeast, where they're just spraying and spreading salt everywhere.
Thank you to Texas Rovers for your hospitality and for the event, inviting me down, and had a nice time and handed out stickers and talked to some listeners. And there actually had listeners of the show. I think we got new listeners of the show, which is pretty cool. I don't think anybody looked at me weird as far as what is, you know. Well, I did have people look at me weird. What is a podcast? That did happen. Yes, that did happen a couple times. But yeah, there's. Actually, I found out, and I think Laura had told me that she's the organizer for the whole event.
And she's the one we had on the podcast last year?
Yes, Laura's the one we had on the podcast, and she helped get me down there and get me situated and sorted out. So thanks to Laura for that. So she's the SCAR event coordinator, but lots of help. Right. She has lots of help, certainly. You know, the problem with that is that, you know, when you're the organizer or even a trail leader for those, you don't really get a chance to do your own personal wheeling out there. So she did get to ride at least once that I know of on the Barbatoy run, which was good for her.
So did you I assume you did not drive down. Did you fly down?
I did both, actually. I drove the Jetta to the airport. I took two planes to get to Dallas-Fort Worth, and then I rented a car, had a Nissan Sentra, which actually wasn't too bad, and drove that to the site. So, yes.
Gotcha.
So I did both. I did not drive the 19 hours from Pennsylvania to northeast Texas, which, of course, if I had taken the 109, would have been what? 4 days.
34. Yeah.
Because you can do, you know, as people are like, oh, you didn't drive down. I'm like, why didn't you bring the series? Because I didn't want to drive, you know, 4 hours a day and then have to wait 8 hours to recover, you know, because all that.
So once the Defender is done, can you drive the Defender down towing the series? And that will be.
Ooh.
That'd a little more comfortable, but probably take roughly about the same amount of time while you're towing.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's interesting thought. I'd take the I think you could take the Defender off road there and not. I mean, there's always a chance you could hurt something, but generally you'd be all right.
Nice.
Yeah, because they're wide. Yeah, the trails. That's actually, you bring up a good point. The trails are pretty wide, and there's not a lot of overhang. There are a couple places with overhang from trees and such, but yeah, there's a. as we like to call Pennsylvania pinstriping, that's you're not in Pennsylvania, so there's a good chance that that won't happen. Yeah, because the wide trails kind of cut back. There's a little bit of water, some mud, but not too much. Kind of a clay base for most of that, with some rocks and not really boulders, but bigger rocks. A little bit of loose rock. I would definitely say that, you know, if it rains, say half an inch or, you know, kind of a more than just a little rain, it would definitely increase the difficulty factor on all those trails because they have that, you know, that kind of that clay base. Not a topsoil. There's not a lot of dirt. So that would be definitely increase the your challenge factor there.
But slip and slide.
Yes. which apparently they've had in the past. So highly recommend the event. If it'll take place again at the same time next year. Highly recommend it. And if you're in the neighborhood, get yourself down there and go to the event. Good value for money too, for what you pay and what you get. I think that's it's the most excellent event. Very, very well done and organized and maintained. And finally, wrap it up officially. I guess I keep wrapping it up for 10 minutes. Thanks to Texas Rovers for their hospitality and having us down there, having the show down there.
Very nice. Sounds like a lot of fun. Do you think you'll go back next year?
With everything being equal, yes.
Nice.
Yeah, I'd go back. Timing wise, I would probably go to the Sand Rover Rally just to go to something different and.
Right. Yeah. Considering the distance you have to travel to get there, yes. Whereas I assume most of the people, aside from press, are relatively local.
Majority are. There's people though come from all over Texas. There were a couple that came from Pennsylvania that trailered their discos in. Some folks from Ohio. Some of them are vendors too. But most of the folks are from that area. Sarah, who helps, she originally is from Texas or had attended when she was in Texas and now lives in Atlanta. But they drive their disco. From Atlanta and make a point to go every year because they enjoy the event so much. So I'd say, yeah, majority, probably 85%. I'm just throwing out a number, or probably from the Texas area.
Excellent.
Welcome back to the Sinister Podcast, show number 49 for April 2017. Our guest this month is Martin Port. He's the art director of Classic and Sports Car Magazine. He's also contributor to Classic Land Rover Magazine. Martin is in the UK, joining us via Skype. Welcome to the show, Martin.
Thank you very much. On the anniversary of the launch of the Land Rover, I believe.
Oh, I think, yeah. Well, it's the, isn't it the 50th anniversary, too, of the Range Rover?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, so pretty momentous day to be.
and it's also
that it is.
It's also the day after my mother's birthday, so that's also.
Oh, well, there you momentous. Go. Yes. Anniversaries all around.
Martin and I had a nice exchange over Twitter, and that got him onto the show. And you have some interesting stories around Land Rovers, Martin, and that's the main reason I wanted to have you on the show. I will give a little anticipation for folks. One involves Star Wars. Which is pretty cool. So, Martin, you're the art editor. What exactly is an art editor?
it's a job that was created to sound slightly less impressive than art director, I suppose. my role is I'm in charge of the way that the magazine looks, the design, which photographers we use, art directing photo shoots. And any freelance graphical based contributors that come into the magazine. So, but I am responsible for the design of the magazine, basically.
That's very cool. Yeah, yeah, that's great.
But I'm very fortunate in that I can string a few words together as well. I'm not completely Neanderthal, so I do write features for our magazine as well as Land Rover magazines as well. So
right.
It's a bit of a busman's holiday, as they say.
A busman's holiday. Now that's a British term I've not heard before.
Oh, well, there you go.
That's a new one.
Means most people would go, that's not a job.
Ah, okay. Oh, I see. Busman's holiday.
Gotcha.
Gotcha. I just for the record, you know, I spent an Anglophile certainly, and I spent 6 months in London and picked up a lot of things, but busman's holiday, that's a new one.
You can have that one.
Thank you. Hey, thanks. I appreciate that.
By the way.
So you did not immediately become a Land Rover person. You spent many years in a Porsche.
I did, yeah. I mean, well, if you like, that was the straw that broke the camel's back. You probably have that saying as well over there.
We do. So I
when I learned to drive, I immediately got into classics and went down the traditional route, I suppose, over here at least, of British stuff on the cheap end of the market, Morris Minors and MGBs and what have you, and went through a fair few cars because we were using them as just, you know, daily driver cars rather than weekend classics. And that's myself and my wife as well. So, you know, we were running MGBs and Minis and what have you. And I yearned for something a little more exotic. And so went and did what you should never, ever do, and particularly the one thing that we preach on the magazine that you should never do, and that's buy a cheap Porsche at auction. sharp
Doctor healed thyself.
But it was not all bad, though.
What Porsche did you pick up?
Well, I bought I couldn't afford a 911, so I bought a 1967 Porsche 912, which, if you're familiar with it, was actually more popular stateside than over here, and is the same as a 911, but with the running gear out of, or the engine out of a 356. So it was a flat four air cooled instead of the flat six, which actually, not going too far off the topic of Land Rovers for too long, meant that it was a car with near 50-50 weight distribution. So it handles better than a 911.
Ooh.
Very nice.
So you can drive it on the limit all the time, everywhere, but look good doing it, because it would never come back to bite you.
I admit I'm not a Porsche person, so I don't know as much. Actually, that's cool stuff. I know there are a couple of listeners that are Porsche people, so that they'll appreciate that.
Well, there you go. Well, this one came was, it was a Culver City car, actually. So it was a Californian car that came to England. But the long story is that I ran around with it in it for a few years. We spent an awful lot of money that I didn't really have rebuilding the engine, and we hill climbed it and did all sorts of stuff. And it was a cool car, a great looking car, fantastic handling car, but quite a stressful car to own. You know, you couldn't scrimp on using cheap parts because they just didn't fit or weren't available. You had to use the right people to do the job if anything needed doing to it. And that was quite a stressful situation. So when I finally was forced to get rid of it, because it turned out that the cheap car at auction scenario came back to bite me, it was completely rotten underneath. I wondered what I could get into that was the complete antidote to that, and it turned out to be a Land Rover. I wanted something that you could, metaphorically speaking, fix with a hammer and paint with a brush, and that was about as close as I could find.
Absolutely. You know, what did you pick up?
So the odd thing is, I mean, as an indication of price, I went and bought my first series Land Rover, which was a late 2A, a 1969 2A. I bought it with the proceeds of selling just the engine out of the Porsche, which was sold the engine for £5,000, and picked up my first Land Rover for just a few thousand. And it was a great vehicle, and I intended to just use it not very frequently, purely because it only did the petrol consumption wasn't exactly fantastic, but I ended up using it every day. And the problem with that was I was commuting to London every day, which was 110 miles a day.
Wow.
I racked up an awful lot of mileage and used an awful lot of petrol quite quickly.
Not diesel, to be clear. It was petrol, not diesel.
Yeah. It was a petrol. Yeah. Yeah. I'm not a fan of diesel engines.
Oh, really?
Purely because I'm more familiar with the workings of a petrol.
Okay. Yeah.
Fair
enough.
Just a personal thing, really. So, yeah.
You know, I bought that one and used it.
I think 2 weeks after I bought it, I drove it from the UK down to Le Mans in France for the classic 24 hours. Just carried on using it basically for the next year.
Wow.
So, very nice.
Sounds like a typical Land Rover owner. Let's do something really big with it the moment we buy it.
Yeah, I think at the time, I mean, that was a few years before the current kind of let's buy a Land Rover as a heritage icon, you know, trend set in, before it became a fashionable thing to do. So prices were still a little bit lower than they are now, to say the least. And they weren't as popular in the circles that I was moving in, working on a classic, car magazine, certainly on one which was more based in sports cars. But the reception it got was pretty cool. So,
oh, yeah, of course. And would I be correct in thinking that the engine in the Porsche was worth more than the entire Land Rover that you bought?
Yep, nearly twice as much.
Wonderful.
And that really summed it up, the fact that I could, well, in the past, I have bought an entire secondhand Land Rover engine for the same amount that it cost me for one exhaust valve on a Porsche, which is just crazy.
Yeah, that's insanity.
Yeah. So it was getting out of the Porsche scene was therapy and relief in equal measures, I think.
What else did you do with the 2A?
Crikey. Well, I mean, I just used it. It was like my first Land Rover experience, really. So it was a case of doing everything that I possibly could with it. I was very fortunate in that it snowed very heavily that year, which is in the UK where it's not a given that we're going to get snow over winter. It was fantastic. I had the birth of my youngest son coincided with that heavy snowfall. And so with the midwife not being able to come out to us just after he was born, it was great to be able to strap him in and take him for his checkups and what have you, where no one else could drive around, which was great. And yeah, I towed everything I could, used a trailer at every opportunity, went off road on a weekly basis, as well as driving up and down the motorways of Britain. So little wonder, therefore, that after about a year and a half, I sold it.
What?
Yeah.
What's wrong with you?
I wasn't ready for it. Now, this is the life-affirming moment, if you like. I suddenly realized that I wasn't ready to give up overtaking. I hadn't conditioned myself for it. Let's put it that way. And that year and a half had been fantastic. But in a rash moment, I decided that the 13 miles to the gallon that I was getting out of the 2A was not acceptable. And I wanted to be able to overtake. And so I bought another project, which turned out to be something which I don't know whether you'll have come across over there, but it was a Reliant Scimitar.
No.
Ring any bells? No. It's a British-made car, which sounds like a great idea. It's got a fantastic engine, a Ford 3-litre V6, which was more economical than the Land Rover. But it was a glass fibre body, which needs a lot of repair. So I managed to find that as a project and restore that over the course of a year, but realized that the Land Rover had really got under my skin and I had to have another one. So I very quickly sold it. I bought another 2A, a 64 short wheelbase, and never looked back.
smart man. Well, a couple comments. One, we know what Reliant Robins are, having watched only Fools and Horses for many years, and also Top Gear, of course. We're familiar with Reliant Robins. Was it the Scimitar? Is that what it was? I assume it's a four wheel.
It's a four wheel. It was sold at the time as kind of a four seater GT sports car, really, I suppose. But it was it wasn't the best handling car. Great engine, but the rest of it, the build quality was not fantastic, and I think that was really its downfall. But a very, very good and quick car and great sounding car, twin pipes and everything, for a good car for going in a straight line, but cornering wasn't its strength. it went on to a new owner and I went back to more familiar territory.
Well, see, the problem you had with overtaking is you need a second car, one that then can do the overtaking. See, I have a Jetta TDI that gets that out of the system for me, so that when I do jump into Series 3 and I go, oh, you know, I wish I was going a little faster. No, it's okay. I can, I still have the Jetta for that.
Well, we've got a 1971, actually, it's just on the cusp, a Beetle, Volkswagen Beetle that is my wife's car. And so I use that. I refer to it as the modern car because I pack less tools in case of breakdown. plus, it'll go motorway speed. I use that if I want to go somewhere faster.
Have British motorway speeds gone up in the last couple of years? I just was thinking this off the top of my head that, you know, in America we've raised the speed limits from 55 up to 70, 75 in some states. Has that happened in the UK?
No, it depends whether you're talking about theoretically or legally, because legally they're still the same. It's still 70 miles an hour, theoretically, in actual fact, should I say. Realistically, everyone drives at about 50 miles an hour now because wherever they're doing roadworks, they've put in these average speed cameras. Mm-hmm. So you can only do 50 miles an hour, which is perfect for owning a Land Rover. So I think that's why I don't miss overtaking anymore, because you can't.
Very nice.
Yeah, here in America, the legal speed limit may be 70, 75. But the actual speed people go is usually 10 or 15 miles above that.
Yeah, yeah. It's a bad place to drive at the moment, the UK. I wouldn't come here again.
Yeah, interesting. Oh, well, that's interesting. Yeah, yeah. You mean just because of the roadworks and all that?
Yeah, I think the problem is that the roads are so congested over here. They're still clutching at straws, really, trying to come up with solutions and ever widening and using up, what we have over here, the hard shoulder, is now an extra lane controlled by some sort of kind of overhead lighting, I suppose, which means that as soon as somebody breaks down, well, it's back to a three-lane motorway. Wow. And everything grinds to a halt. So it's not great.
Sure. All right. Well, back to your Land Rover path here. Yeah. So I just thought of because I just traveled to Texas and here where I live in Pennsylvania, you can go, there's 70 on some places, but Texas seems like everywhere was 70, but everyone was doing 80, 85. And anyway, yeah, that's why it came up in my head about how, I thought that was different, because when I was in the UK a couple of years ago, I did notice all the speed cameras and it didn't seem like there were a lot of people. They were going to speed limit. That was it. And then, it's like, okay, yeah, takes all the fun in my mind out of it. But
oh, absolutely, yeah,
yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, you know, break the law and all that business. But they just went there. There is a limit to what a road can handle, and then what someone can react to. And yeah, so there should be speed limits, but roads are, at least in America, they're certainly in interstates, they're designed to handle, 100 miles an hour. They're designed that way. They're supposed to only have a 2-degree turn every mile or something. So that it pretty much they're straight. They can handle the higher speeds, but they just want their money at the end of the day too. That's the,
yeah. Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah. So, so you picked up, you returned to Land Rover world. It was in the green was in your blood, and you picked up a 64 2A, and you actually went back in time, because the original one was a 67 2A, is that right?
669 was the first one that I bought. Okay. So for some reason I had in my mind at that time that my ideal would be a late 2A with the lights in the wings, but that kind of went against my general classic car passion, I suppose, which is earlier is usually better. I went backwards to a 64 lights in the grill 2A.
It's a good look, though. That's a good look.
Yeah. It wasn't a look that I was particularly fond of to start with, I think. But as I got more into Land Rovers, it became the one that I wanted. I know people make a big thing about, not paying a premium for earlier vehicles, but that's my personal preference.
And you still have that, is that right?
No, actually, oh. No, that's just gone. It went to a new owner just this Christmas, really.
Oh. Are we getting ahead of ourselves in the story?
A new project.
I think we're getting ahead of ourselves in the story. Let's go back. So you picked up that 2A, and I think that became your daily driver. Is that right?
Yeah, that stepped into the commuting fray once more, and I did 13,000 miles a year in that for quite a few years. Yeah. So with relatively few breakdowns.
Come on. If it's not a breakdown, it's not a Land Rover. Come on.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Hey, it stuck in third gear once. The starter motor disintegrated in the bell housing once. What else? Yeah. Nothing drastic apart from that, really. So, yeah, sure. I had to find a new gearbox and pull the gearbox back several times in the space of a month because I stupidly thought I wouldn't put a new clutch in. And obviously the week after I'd put a new starter motor in and retrieved all the bits out of the bell housing, the clutch went. So, But of course that just meant I did it better and quicker the second time. So
right. Practice.
Yeah. did lots of things with that. Took that down to again, Le Mans for a couple of trips. Lots of stuff around the UK.
That truck also has a good history, doesn't it? In addition to your own.
The 64 not any history of note, to be honest. The 64 belonged to someone that we knew on the magazine, or they weren't on the magazine. Sorry, they were a dealer that one day decided that he wanted to buy a Land Rover, and so dispatched one of his men to go and buy him a Land Rover. And came back with a 64 2A, short wheelbase petrol. He drove it once or twice, and then by his own admission went, well, I don't like Land Rovers, so sold it to me, which was good for me.
Did you always use that car, or did you get another Land Rover? Now that it's in your blood, then you know you're not going to get rid of it.
Well, that was the thing. I had I started to hanker after Series 1s, but with the prices going just, silly, I ruled myself out of doing that. And so I decided that 64 2A was the one that I was going to keep. I had no reason to get rid of it. The family liked it. My two boys and I, went camping in it a lot. It did everything from commuting to fairly serious off-roading sometimes. And was just a real general workhorse, but a nice original one that I hand painted in a car park at 6 o'clock in the morning at work, and slowly wore the paint in. It was a good honest Land Rover, so I had no reason to get rid of it. And I said so to myself one evening, and then the next day, I found myself with another carrot being dangled in front of me.
Dun, dun, dun.
Mm. On that cliffhanger.
So
the series 2, 59.
So you end up then with how did the 59 come to your, come into the fold?
Well, so I was working by that time for Classic Land Rover magazine. And so always on the lookout for good stories. And one day I visited the Series 2 Club forum on the internet, as I do most days. And there was a post that had been put up by a chap asking for some advice on a Series 2. And he gave a little bit of background. And I immediately thought, well, this would make a great story for the magazine. So managed to get the family to agree for me to go to their house in London and see this Land Rover. And the background was the owner had unfortunately passed on fairly recently, hence them asking for some advice. But he had bought the Land Rover brand new in 1959. He was working for the government as a Crown agent out in northern Rhodesia in Africa. And when his contract had ended, he decided that he wanted to fulfill his ambition to drive solo across the Sahara Desert. So what As better to do it in than a Land Rover? Yeah, absolutely. Well, he was an Australian, a fairly young Australian who was no stranger to travel. He had no qualms about doing such a thing. So just got on and did it. And in July, 22nd of July, 1959 Land Rover left Solihull, got on a boat and made its way down to Lusaka in Rhodesia, and then he picked it up from there, drove it down to Cape Town, and started his journey, which would take him best part of 3 years.
Wow. Did he ever write a book?
No, regrettably, he didn't keep any journals or diaries or anything like that. So my information that I managed to get from the family was, you know, stories that he had passed on to his widowed partner, mm-hmm. And the, you know, the rest of the family, it made for a great story. And so I wrote a feature, photographed this Land Rover that had been sat without moving a single wheel for 20 years in the front garden of a townhouse in Shepherd's Bush, which is an area of London.
Only fools and horses again, right? Isn't Shepherd's Bush only fools and horses?
Sorry,
isn't Shepherd's Bush where only fools and horses took place, or am I mistaken?
Oh, that's Peckham.
There we go. Sorry, Peckham. I don't know why I remember Shepherd's Bush for some reason.
But I won't claim to profess too much, because I don't know London that well, apart from the bits that I know, go to and work in. But yeah, so it was sat in their front yard, the front garden in Shepherd's Bush. He had been using it, but it had been motionless for 20 years and firmly wedged in an ivy bush in the front garden, covered in all sorts of undergrowth and what have you. And I went and wrote his story, and then a year later, amazingly, was offered the chance to actually take ownership of it.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, it was very nice of them to do that. I did pay them some money for it, so don't worry, it wasn't a freebie. But they it came with an awful lot of history, and fortunately, although he didn't write any diaries or journals or keep any notes of his trip, what he did do, he's a very, very keen photographer, and so I have about 700 photographs that he took. Wow. During his trip, a lot of them featuring the Land Rover and landmarks and what have you, which made for, you know, great resource material. Yeah, the real good thing about the journey is, apart from that, he came across a film unit. In fact, he had a radio fitted in the cab of the Land Rover, and he heard a plea from the local radio station that this film unit, which was Paramount Pictures, had a shortage of toilet paper. Pause for comedic effect.
Yeah, exactly.
And could anyone help them out? So he immediately rushed to their help, with thinking, well, I might be able to get some work out of this, and delivered some toilet paper. And they were filming Hatari, which was a film with John Wayne as the main star. And so the first owner, who I haven't even name checked yet, his name was Philip Kohler. He turned up every day for a week at 5 o'clock in the morning until the director, Howard Hawks, said, okay, I'll give you some work. So he then spent, I think it was 4 months on set helping out.
Wow.
So that was pretty cool. So the great thing is, of course, I've got lots of photographs of him on the set with John Wayne and what have you.
Do you know what he did on set?
It was just a general, you know, whatever was asked of him. By the looks of it,
production assistant, I think they call that.
Yeah, that would be it. Yeah, yeah, probably runner as well nowadays.
Right.
So when that was over, he carried on his journey and started to move west across Africa. And then lo and behold, came across another film unit, which this time was 20th Century Fox, and they were filming The Lion, which starred William Holden. He ended up getting another, I think it was another 4 months work out of that, and ended up actually as William Holden's stunt double on a scene where they were being charged by a rhino in a Jeep. Not the rhino was in a Jeep. They were in a Jeep. And the rhino. You get a picture.
Wow.
So that started his career in film, really. So then he carried on his journey. And in 1963, he landed back in the UK, to a flurry of snowfall. So I've got this very odd looking Land Rover pictured in a very heavy snow outside Buckingham Palace in 1963, full of all sign written, because it's been sign written as the journey went on with each location that he visited and the dates that he was there. Because he got fed up of being asked where he'd been, and so he decided that he would basically paint on the side each location and date and the duration. So I've got this historical document which moves around under its own steam.
Impressive. So what's roughly the route that he took? Obviously, it's probably kind of all over the place, but
yeah, I mean, obviously the names you know, the division of the country has changed quite a lot since then, but he basically went from Cape Town up the eastern side, and then across, neatly skirting around the Congo, which even then wasn't a good place to be, until he could get into the Sahara, basically. He went across the Sahara. Nairobi, what have you, into Sahara, and then up through Morocco, and into Algeria, Spain, back to London.
Very cool.
So the listing of countries is on the truck?
The listing of countries, yeah.
Where?
There are,
on the outside, inside?
On the hard top sides, and whoa, they're duplicated on each side. So the tub of the Land Rover itself is written with a big Trans Africa writing across each side. Underneath that, there's an African phrase which, interpreted, basically means haste has no blessing, which is quite ironic or suitable for a Land Rover. On each of the hardtop sides is documented the entire journey from the moment he left Cape Town. I think he's the last entry on it was basically when he got into Jerez in Spain.
And they're still listed on the truck?
It's homeward bound and he'd get on with it, you know.
And they're still listed on the side of the truck?
Yeah, still listed.
That's cool.
The good thing is that even though obviously the weather has taken its toll because it's lived outside all of its life, because it's duplicated on both sides, where it's worn away on one side, you can see the missing bits on the other side. So the challenge I have now is to seal that in, mm-hmm, lacquer it somehow without it reacting to the relatively fragile paint without losing anything. So, you know, I need to keep that for prosperity, really. And that was one of the reasons why it came to me, because right from the outset, I made sure that the family were aware that my opinion was that the most important thing that could happen to this was that all the history stayed together, you know, rather than find some unscrupulous dealer that would blast the whole thing, paint it bronze green and sell it for as much money as they could.
you're doing good work. I mean, that's
very good work.
That's spectacular.
Well, that's good. Well
done. No, we're full support. No, that's story truck and keeping that. I don't know. I think you guys use this in the UK, but you know, that patina to it, and that has that history. It's something to preserve. Yeah. That's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, I was very, very lucky in that it's a very, very original truck. But the last time that it was on the road, like I said, 20 years ago, it had been sat for some time before that. But a family member, a distant family member, wanted to use it for their wedding. Mm. And so he was an engineer. And so did possibly the best thing that could be done. He took the vehicle. He stripped it down. He repaired the bulkhead, had it galvanized. The same with the chassis. put everything back together exactly how it was before, with the exception of a new wiring loom, used it for his wedding, and then gave it back. And so there it sat. So while everyone was walking past this algae-ridden, you know, Land Rover that looked to all intents and purposes like it was abandoned, it was actually a very solid proposition underneath. Despite the fact that the engine hadn't been started for 20 years, when we dragged it out, it took us a maximum of 10 minutes to get the engine started. And it just sat and idled, you know, absolutely fantastically, better than my 64 2A at that time.
Wow. So correct me if I'm wrong, but that was not a very common practice to galvanize the chassis and bulkhead at that time, correct?
No, I mean, we're talking about 1990s then. So although it was, you know, it was coming into, I suppose, fashion, you know, we were probably still at the end of people getting just localized repairs done and, you know, fitting new cross members and what have you. So the galvanizing has really made sure that it was still going to be around now. So it was a lifesaver, I think, as far as the Land Rover is concerned.
That's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. But we've been very lucky, and I set myself the prospect of a year to get this Land Rover back on the road. But we very, very quickly established that it was not going to take that long at all, and we had to replace the hydraulics and sort out charging and rebuild water pumps and things like that. But 6 weeks after dragging it out, and it was driving on the road.
Outstanding.
Admittedly, at that point, it still had we were not charging, and we had a leaking water pump. With it being the earlier version, we had to strip that down and press new internals into it and what have you. But we exhibited it 6 weeks after we dragged it out at the big classic motor show that we have here in Birmingham. Sure. And 2 weeks after that, we sorted the rest of the issues, and I think, yeah, 8.5 weeks after we dragged it out of where it was resting, it was doing its first commute to London. So
what was the interior like? What was the configuration? Did he do anything special to it?
Well, he slept in the Land Rover for the entire journey through Africa. So the passenger side had basically a full length, or he had had a full length homemade bed that bridged the bulkheads. Mm-hmm. But it was nothing more really than a kind of wooden bracket attached to the bulkhead behind the front seats, with some slabs of timber put on there for him to sleep on. So by the time, obviously, he'd been using it when he came back from Africa, so although there were bits and bobs still in place, the bulk of it was returned to, you know, normal three seats up front spec, and a couple of bench seats in the back. But we had the original elephant hide seats in the rear, although they're too fragile to use. Yeah. And some of the front seats as well. But it's a very, very original truck, apart from obviously the fact that the bulkhead has been repaired and galvanized. But we had so much history, and when we were cleaning it out, we uncovered in the back two very, very large metal traveling trunks, which we just knew that were going to be something special. As soon as we opened them up, they were packed full of original period Lucas spares that he had taken with him throughout his journey, some African artifacts, traveling cutlery, a spare head gasket that was wrapped in a 1963 copy of the London Evening Standard newspaper. It was, you know, it was just like a treasure chest, to be honest with you. Amazing. So we were very, very
This is cool stuff. Cool. One more time, what was this gentleman's name?
Philip Kohler. Kohler. And he was an Australian I'm trying to remember where they were. I can't recall. But his family were no strangers to traveling, and his father had come to London to study as a doctor, hence the reason why he aged, I think, 20 or something, had decided to basically backpack around Europe,
right?
Which is how he ended up in London.
So, okay, you've danced around it. I gotta ask about it because I hinted at it at the beginning. What's the Star Wars connection?
Okay, so when he did come back to the UK, he had decided that he'd had this taster for film, for the film industry, and wanted to carry on. And after a little bit of a difficult start, because it's a bit of a catch-22 situation, you had to get effectively a union card, a work card, to be able to work in the film industry. Mm-hmm. But you had to have experience to get that. So it took a few years before he managed to get that card. But he got into the film industry, carried on, and ended up as production manager and location manager on an impressive range of titles, including The Empire Strikes Back, where he was responsible for, I believe, all the locations for the Hoth scene.
Oh,
that is really cool.
Well,
so in actual fact, last year the family auctioned off his original crew suit from that film, and it made an impressive amount of money. He worked on Star. He worked on The Empire Strikes Back and a number of the James Bond franchise. Let's think: Octopussy, GoldenEye, Living Daylights. He worked on Killing Fields, Full Metal Jacket.
That's a great film, Full Metal Jacket.
Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Oh, wow.
A lot of really impressive stuff.
So I want the record to show I'm now 1, 2, 3 degrees of separation from the Star Wars franchise.
Yeah, and there was a strange twist, really, in that here I was owning this vehicle that had feasibly been, used by somebody who was on set, on Star Wars, on The Empire Strikes Back. I have another odd connection to that, which is my brother-in-law is key sculptor on the latest round of Star Wars films. There's a there's a strange family link that takes it all full circle. Yeah.
Was the truck actually on set? Do you know? Like, did he take it to the different locations?
No, I don't, I knew that he did, not for Empire Strikes Back, because of course that was, wherever it was it Denmark or somewhere? I can't remember, Finland, somewhere snowy anyway.
I thought they filmed in Norway, at least the Hoth stuff.
Norway, there you go, Norway.
I think so.
Geography's never been my strong point. Norway. But he did use it certainly in the UK. For any films that he was doing, and in fact, I've got receipts of it being serviced at Pinewood Studios garage by the workshop mechanics there.
Sweet,
which is quite cool.
Pinewood is a storied studio. It's more the James Bond franchise, as you said, the Star Wars franchise, all sorts of films. Yeah.
So that's pretty cool. It's a great story to have, and I like to think the fact that, he used it, he used the Land Rover so much and put it through everything that he did through Africa and then back in the UK, that he would approve of it being back on the road and used every day now.
I was doing some searching while you were talking just so we can clarify where Empire Strikes Back was filmed. Let's see here. The Millennium Falcon built on a soundstage at Elstree in Hertfordshire. The ice planet Hoth was filmed on a glacier. I'm not going to say, I can't say the name. It looks like Finland. So I think you were correct.
Is it
Finnis? No. Wait a minute. Hold on. At Finnis, F-I-N-S-E, in the heart of some mountain plateau. Finnis is at the foot of the glacier. It's easily accessible by rail, 2.5 hours from Bergen and a half hour from Oslo. The rail station at Finnis is the highest in Europe, silhouetted between a park and another park. So that's Norway. I was right. I think it is Norway.
Oh, there you go.
Hey.
See, there you go. You got there in the end.
We rarely fact check during the show. That's our...
Well, let this be a first. It's a good job this isn't a Star Wars podcast. Otherwise, we'd all be in trouble.
Indeed, right. Indeed. You know, there's a big star. There's a big star. What are they? Fan club. You know, there's a Star Wars fan club. But that's not the right word for it. But folks that, and I have friends that do this. They dress up and they go do community works. And the group that I know is in a they'll whatever their favorite character is. They'll dress up and then they do literacy campaigns for kids and things like that. I think it's called the Garrison. And they were in my neighborhood a couple of years ago, and I said, hey, why don't you come on out and check us out and all that stuff. I'm like, sure, we got for lunch. And I take them my series 109 I've got, and which is you're probably not aware, but it's a XMOD 109. I had it imported in 09, but it served in Wales, and so it's camo, got running boards. So I've got these Star Wars characters hanging all over my 109. This is great. So there's a minor Star Wars connection with the 109. Not the same as yours.
Well, mine's still fairly tenuous, but it's there still.
No. Yours is legit. You own the truck of the location manager for the Star Wars film. There we go. Let's kick it. I mean, I think, we could end the podcast right there, but we're not, but we could. That's cool.
End on a high.
Yes, exactly. Let's end on a high note. So you wrote an article then for that. Is that article still available? Can folks get to it? Can we provide folks a link?
Oh, crikey. Yeah, cannot remember which issue it was.
We'll add this in at some point, so don't worry.
Yeah, I'll
track it down. It'll take me a week before we get this posted, so.
Yeah, so I wrote that, and like I say, I tried to help them out by ensuring that it was going to be looked after by somebody, finding it a good home.
Didn't
really expect that, a year later they would come back to me and offer me the chance to be that person. But there was no my obsession with the vehicle had already been cemented by that point, so there was no chance really of me saying no.
Yeah, well, clearly they saw your passion and not only for the Land Rover, but I think also for maintaining it in its current state, and you understand the history behind it, and you were going to honor that, and clearly you've done that. So kudos to you, sir. I mean, that's not an easy thing to do.
Well, that's the key thing, as far as I was concerned. I love a vehicle with history, whatever it is. Much prefer it to, £1 million restorations. Right. Because as far as I'm concerned, the history of a vehicle starts being formed the moment that, people start hammering it into shape in a factory. Mm-hmm. And that is important that it stays with it. If it's, whether it's just the same owner driving it to the shops once a week for 50 years, or whether it's somebody who takes a Land Rover through the hardest terrain of Africa, it doesn't really matter. It's still important to that vehicle, and I think it should be celebrated where possible and kept with it.
That takes us back to our favorite Top Gear quote, it does important things for important people.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, we're hoping to bring it full circle, and we are in the early stages of planning a return trip to Africa with it, because we thought it would be good and very fitting to take it back there and retrace some of the journey. Political instabilities make it impossible to do some of that, and we haven't got 3 years to spare. But we will certainly retrace some of the stuff, probably in Northern Africa.
And that's it. Yeah. When's that plan? Do you have that, or is it just an idea?
Hopefully, right, the next couple of years.
Yeah. Good. Yeah. Well, you're now officially a friend of the show. We want you to come back and talk to us about that in advance, when it happens and after it happens, because that's cool stuff.
We'll do a live link from the center of the Sahara.
We'll do it. That we need to do. That'd be cool. You'll be in the truck. Does it have a name, by the way? Everybody, folks like to name their Land Rovers. Does this truck have a name?
It doesn't, no.
That's
no.
Fine.
I've only ever named Hoth. One vehicle.
It could be called Hive.
That somebody else named it. So no, this, it doesn't have a name. It's,
That's fine. You could call it the Kohler after Mr. Kohler, after Philip Kohler, called the Kohler. That's a good name.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I should call it Philip, actually. Yeah.
Or call it Philip. Oh, even better. Sweet. So the 300 photos that he took, are those available anywhere? Like, have you maybe posted all of those on a Smug Mug or something?
Well, we've been slowly publishing them in installments in Classic Land Rover magazine. We're just about to print the third installment, which has got some of the historical photos. But what I will do also at some point is to upload some of them to a gallery, an online gallery, and then right. I'll let you know what they are, so you can spread the word.
That's called Rover porn, by the way.
Absolutely.
I'd love to see. Is the one at Buckingham Palace with the snow? Has that already been published?
It hasn't. No, okay. It hasn't. So yeah, that's a new one, unseen. But there are literally so many. I've been working my way through scanning them, and I'm only on the second box of three, and then I've got another whole folder full of negatives as well, which need scanning. So it's very time consuming, but so very cool. Rewarding.
It is. That's so cool. That's very cool. If you secretly send me the picture of the Buckingham Palace one, I won't share with anybody. I won't.
I can do that.
Or just hold it up on Skype and show it to us.
Yeah. That'd be cool. I'll do that when we finish.
fair enough.
Have those photos and negatives held up as well as the Land Rover has?
They're astonishing. Absolutely astonishing. The color positive transparencies are all Kodachrome, and they've got a fantastic quality to them. Which means that, you know, you can scan them really big. I mean, we made very big exhibition panels for when we showed it at the Classic Motor Show out of them. So we ended up printing them kind of 6 foot tall, and they held up so well. And the transparencies, sorry, the negatives, yeah, they're just the amount of detail that's in them has been not just very lovely to look at, but also very useful in terms of putting things back on the Land Rover, because you know, when he came back into the UK, he took lots of the little badges and little things that he'd added to the Land Rover through his trip. He took it off and just packed them all away. So every week, it seems, I'm going through stuff wondering, well, what that hole was for, and all I need to do is go to a box of bits, pick out something that I think might fit, check it against photographs, and I'm finding, you know, that everything matches up, and it's been really valuable in piecing the history together.
Wow. It really doesn't get much better than that.
No. <It's pretty laughs> cool. I mean, one of the lovely little things was he had Northern Rhodesian and East African versions of the AA badges, which is, you know, recovery organization.
Yeah.
Available throughout the world, but their specific regional badges used to be produced, metal badges, and we were aware that they had been fitted to the Land Rover across the front during his journey, and they had all been wrapped carefully in newspaper and put away in these metal trunks, and everything that he had been so meticulously saved. We were always wondering where one of the number plates had gone. And I'll briefly backtrack a little bit. When the Land Rover was shipped down to Rhodesia from the UK, it was assigned a number plate, which is P1446, and that was painted on the body, on the front wing and on the rear. And then as he travelled through into East Africa, it would be assigned a different number, which is KHD613. And then when it came to the UK, it was given a UK registration. Now, I could see that the Rhodesian number was painted on the body still underneath the UK number plate, but the East African number plate, we had no idea where it was. And it just seemed odd that given his, like I say, his meticulous, you know, wrapping up and storing of everything, that these plates were nowhere to be seen. And it was whilst giving it a little bit of a polish hours before we opened at the Classic Motor Show, I thought, I'll just take the front number plate off so we can show the Rhodesian plate underneath, only to find out when I turned the UK number plate over, that all he'd done was take the East African number plates, spin them over, paint a UK plate on it, and screw it back onto the body. So, you know, there is everything about this vehicle is complete.
Wow.
This just gets better and better. That's amazing.
There was a padlock on the underseat toolbox on the passenger side, and we wondered what was in it. So we got a disc cutter and cut the padlock off, only to find that there was a complete set of 1959 workshop manuals and parts books. The good old green Bibles were in there.
Wow.
Wow.
you don't get just speechless just too often.
Yeah, it's just so impressive.
Amazing. Yeah, very lucky.
Damn. And any sense of how many miles are on it? And is that the original engine?
It is the original. Well, as far as we're aware, it's the original engine. There was no engine number recorded on the factory records that we have available, but it is a 1959 dated engine. I recently had to take the cylinder head off to replace the exhaust valves, a couple of which had started to burn out, and dated the cylinder head to that early 59 to 62 period as well. So I have no reason to doubt that any of it is not original. Even the wheels are stamped 1959 on the wheel rims. So pretty sure that everything that is there, with the exception of obviously, you know, the odd ancillaries, is original. I mean, it's been fitted with a Weber 34 ICH carburetor, as lots were once Solex has started to disintegrate, but I've got the original Solex in a box with it. So I will have that overhauled at some point and refitted.
Wow. I'm just flabbergasted. It's a great truck with great history, and it's found a great owner. That's clear. And I think, you know, continue to commend you, sir, for what you're doing. Yeah, that's
the important thing to stress is that, right from the outset, I had no intention of keeping it as some museum piece that wasn't going to be used. Mm-hmm. So it gets used every day, either to travel up and down to London doing the 100-odd miles, the other week I was carrying 30 square meters of turf in the back for the garden, and a load of timber for building retaining walls. It just gets used in the same vein as any other Land Rover, as far as I'm concerned.
That's fantastic. Fantastic. So, wow.
That is.
My aim, apart from just taking it back to Africa, is to also put together a book, ironically, linking back to what you were saying earlier, is to put together a book that does touch upon the Land Rover. It's to include some of his wonderful photographs from when he was a traveling, fresh graduate through Europe, through his work in Rhodesia to buying the Land Rover, through to his film work. So that's a project which is starting to take shape. So
that's cool.
Hopefully that will be one for travel enthusiasts and Land Rover enthusiasts to look out for at some point.
That's and you'll have to come on the show and tell us all about that.
I will be.
good. I had one other question about Mr. Kohler, because I know we have at least one listener from Australia. Do you know where from Australia Mr. Kohler is from?
Embarrassingly, I've got it written down somewhere in some of my copious notes, but I cannot remember off the top of my head.
That's
he says reaching.
No worries, no worries. Something. It's fine.
Yes. No, I can't remember.
Okay. Oren might be curious to see. I think Oren lives around Melbourne, if I recall correctly. I know we have a listener there. And
I've got in my head it was Brisbane or Melbourne, and I can't remember which.
Martin, great stories. We need to have you back, because I know you have more stories that you can tell us. And so you're automatically invited back in a couple months to give us more stories. I appreciate you telling us what you did about Mr. Kohler, his truck, and your own background.
Yeah, no problem at all. I enjoyed it, and look forward to coming back and talking more.
That's the podcast for this month of April 2017. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I want to thank you for listening. I also want to thank our guest this month, Martin Port, the art editor of Classic and Sport Car magazine, also contributor to Classic Land Rover. magazine. He will be on the show again in the future. We've not recorded any of that, but he will be on in the future because he's got more stories of Land Rovers that we want to hear about. One in particular is that he has a story of being handed the keys to Roger Craythorne Series 1.
Yes, we want to hear that story.
Got to hear that story. That might be a show in and of itself. Thanks to the One True Pax for his production support. Thanks to the contributors to the show, Harold, who's not here, but also to Morgan, who is here.
Thank you.
And don't forget to visit seriesparts.com for all your series parts needs.
Yeah.
That sound good?
It does.
That
was nice, thank you. Little
catchphrase. Yeah, you're quite welcome. I remind you to visit our website for past shows and show notes. You can connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Give us your feedback on the show and the topics we covered this month, if you have any. You can directly support the show at patreon.com/centersteer in the British spelling. At least center is spelled in the British way. If you'd like to be a sponsor of the podcast, hey, shoot me an email. And we'd love to hear from you and what you're up to in your Land Rover. But until next time, I ask you to share the show with one other Land Rover fan. Thanks for listening. Wave as we pass by.
Sorry, that was on my end. Door chime.